Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think. The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion. Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Thin Blue Mind. Now, this week we're going to be looking at jury trials and have they had their day? And it's quite a big issue to consider when you think that jury trials have been in existence in the UK for about 1,000 years now. The basic history of a jury trial started in the 8th or 9th century, I believe, where it was actually taken from the Islamic world of North Africa and Spain, kind of introduced to this country through the Norman conquests as a result of the country. Countries they'd had conquered and inherited legal systems. In the 12th century, it became part of the Magna Carta. So it really is enshrined in British history and law. And today we're going to be looking at whether is there now time for a change, perhaps with some of the cases that are prosecuted in the English courts, and whether the jury is fit for purpose. So before we look into various issues surrounding jury trials, what do we all think?
I think it's the best of quite a lot of bad systems that you can have. There are faults with jury trials, I'm sure we'll go into, but it seems a reasonable way of having people look at the evidence, assess the evidence, and decide whether the state's proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt, or so that the jury are sure of the guilt of the defendant. It's the best of a bad lot.
I'd like someone to show me the alternative of a 12-person jury trial. I personally think this should be a threshold level of complex cases, you know, the intricacies of certain electronic frauds, or something which is very, very heavy forensically, maybe. I don't just mean run-of-the-mill, where there needs to be a pool of, quote, experts. Define where that threshold is, I would say, for an expert who would then be called upon to judge that case. Not necessarily the expertise in whatever field they are in, because that would lead them to have some kind of bias, maybe, but have a pool of experts in a field who could understand the elements. But we should not get rid of the jury system, is my point of view.
I've been an expert in the field of computer forensics. The job trained me up to the level where I could give that evidence at court. Part of the trick of giving evidence as an expert is putting the facts forward in a way that the jury can understand it. If you're talking about how hard disk drives work, what's the process of something being recorded onto a CD or a DVD, what's left in memory, that sort of complicated stuff, you have to be able to reduce it to something that's still factually accurate, but which a jury can assimilate and understand.
You make a very good, valid point there, and it is the prosecution's and defence's duty to break that techno-gabble down to something which is legible. But I think there's sometimes when you can break something down to layman's terms and people just still won't understand it. And I think that's where we get issues, don't we? And then it comes down to personalities rather than the facts.
Certainly with something like cell sighting, that is pretty hard to get across to a jury sometimes when the different masts have got different coverage areas and what can affect the coverage areas and what cell sighting surveys are and how they work. It's tricky stuff, and sometimes I've seen a jury not just quite get their heads around that sometimes at court.
Well, Steve, I know you mentioned earlier about you'd like to see, well, what's the alternative to a jury trial? Certainly there's many other countries that do progress trials with just the judge. I think the most famous one I can think of was in South Africa. I can't remember his name. Oscar somebody.
Pistorius.
Yes, that's him. A double amputee who shot his wife, believing her to be an intruder, and certainly that case was overseen by a single judge. But again, I mean, that has issues itself, doesn't it? I mean, we're not talking about 12 people, we're talking about one person now, and can we trust that judge to look at the evidence objectively without bringing anything in from outside, I suppose?
We have been down that road before in the UK, the Diplock courts in Northern Ireland, where you had a judge sitting because there were issues with getting juries, particularly in terrorist cases, to sit. and to hear the evidence. So we ended up with judges doing the deciding as well as the judging.
My view on that is no. Less people that you have, even going down to one person, it goes against everything that the justice system stands for, I think, because that one person is not only open to appeals after appeals after appeals because people will question his subjectivity, it's the fact of you putting too much power in one person's hand. I don't care how learned they are or an expert they are on the law, and they can walk the fine line between points of law that you're looking for. You need a pool of the public.
But isn't it interesting, though, that, and I appreciate what you're saying, and I do tend to agree with you to a certain extent, but we're quite happy to let the courts of appeal adjudicate with three judges.
That's an appeal court, like you said, and that's normally for a point of law that somebody wants to raise or a procedural issue that wasn't done correctly.
I've done some work for Court of Appeal hearings, and it was all around procedural stuff. Was the disclosure correct? Had there been a lack of disclosure that affected the defendant's ability to defend themselves at the first trial? It was all based on that procedural stuff rather than we've got stunning new evidence that proves our client's innocence.
All right, well, let me turn it around a little bit. Let me put it another way. Jury trials, up until about the 15th century, they were actually tasked with finding the evidence as well as finding whether the person was guilty or not guilty. And it was moreover land issues. I think it was Henry II that brought this in. Would you trust modern-day society to diligently, accurately find evidence that would either convict you or acquit you?
I think you're always hoping for, like, a Miss Marple character on the jury. Which I've had, and you can see, as you're giving your evidence, that the penny has dropped with that particular juror, and they've understood the point you're making and how important it is. And you know that, or you hope, when they go back into the jury room for the deliberations, they'll be able to explain because the penny's dropped. Whether you get Miss Marples all the time on the jury, that's a different question, but it's nice when you have one.
I think one of the issues of jury trials now is that, Dave, if you were on trial, and I know I'll get a direction from the judge not to go and do any work on it, but I'd know everything about you before the next morning if you had a social media presence.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? That's going to bring us on to a few other points. But you make a very important point, don't you, about social media, and that's probably the biggest danger, I suppose, to a trial collapsing.
Not only the whole trial collapsing, but quite often that juror getting some prison time.
It's not just that one person. Who else have they contaminated? They come back into the jury room and say, hey, I looked up Dave yesterday and this, that and the other and blah, blah, blah. You can have the life history. You can't unknow what you know.
Yeah.
So straight away we're on a mistrial, aren't we? How much does that cost us?
And it certainly opens a huge crack, doesn't it, from the defence point of view of my client didn't get a fair trial.
There's circumstances, you know, where a previous criminal record can be disclosed and can be part of the evidence. But if it's not there, it's not agreed, but the jurors are bringing it in through doing a bit of research on the local news and the like. That's not right.
It's adapting, isn't it? I think the whole model of having 12 good men and women to try their peers, I think, is the fixed element of all this. And I think that it needs to adapt to the 21st century, whether that be accessibility through social media and through the internet and through Google, whatever site, you can find lots and lots of detail about somebody, or also adapting to the complex nature of cases as well. People's expectations of forensic evidence, for example. When people watch too much CSI, they think that they've got a degree in forensic science, and they expect the forensic evidence to come up to a certain level, and it doesn't.
Well, you mentioned the 21st century bringing the process up, and we keep talking about it, don't we? That in the various podcasts we do about a generational thing, and you know how our generation views life and morals and judgments perhaps a little differently to the current generation and the previous generation to ours similarly. And I'm just wondering, and maybe I'm being a bit unfair to the modern generation, but I do seem to think that emotions and politics are being brought into the jury room.
One benefit of having a jury that's chosen from society is as society changes, as the views in society change as to what is criminally culpable and what is not, you can find that sometimes a jury will be in advance of the law or doing jury nullification, which is where they, despite the evidence, they find a not guilty, for example. We were talking about the case in Bristol where the Colston statue got tuppled into the docks at Bristol, and there was, I think, a prosecution for criminal damage. They were found not guilty. It wasn't quite jury nullification, but the barristers appearing for them told a particular story, gave a particular narrative, set out a particular case, and the jury believed that particular case, that defence that they were raising, and found them not guilty.
It's deciding on points that, one, are not in evidence, and two, are not crucial to the points to prove.
Which is perhaps why some barristers earn more money than others. At the end of it, you're in before the court and you're telling a tale, you're giving a narrative on behalf of your client. It can be that having a barrister who's articulate and can sell that to a jury, that's probably worth the extra money. That's perhaps where jury system's not so good, because it's susceptible to being told a narrative, it's susceptible to being entertained, to having sympathies.
But it's the court's responsibility to bring that jury back to the points to prove and say, if you find A, B, C, D, E equals guilty, not whether you like them or not, or not whether, oh, well, they object to slavery or this, like we all do, but we don't take it in our hands to start toppling statues, do we? The points to prove for criminal damage are quite clear, and the defences for criminal damage are quite clear, and I think other factors get brought in through a very creative and articulate barrister, which have nothing to do with it. So perhaps you then have the safety and of the judge or somebody else who can bring the jury back to the points to prove A plus B plus C equals guilty.
Well, it's interesting you say, isn't it, about evidence presented. And I know back in 2013, I think it was, that Chris Hoon, the then MP, Liberal MP, I think it was, and his wife, Vicky Price, went on trial for perverting the course of justice. She took the rap for his speeding points, basically. So a rather minor offence, but the subsequent offence they committed to try and get out of that was very serious. Perverting the course of justice is basically sticking two fingers up to the courts, and they really don't like that. But it was interesting that the jury initially found Miss Price not guilty. She had a retrial and was eventually found. And it transpired that the jury asked 10 questions during that trial of the judge, and which showed a staggering lack of understanding of the case. And there was an article in the Telegraph, and it goes on to say, it said they were flummoxed by issues that had been made extremely clear in the trial, particularly when it came to the definition of reasonable doubt and the fact that the jury couldn't consider matters that weren't raised in court. Now, I've had personal experience of this. Jurors will discuss these what-if matters, and, you know, I've had to say, look, that's not what we're being asked to do. Don't judge on what might have happened or what the defendant might have been thinking. The judge isn't asking you to do that. They're asking you to find guilt or not on the points and the evidence that's been presented. I think too many times jurors are having this what-if question in their mind and they're not addressing what they're being asked to look at.
I think there's probably always been the what-if questions in jury rooms. I think that's part of what you live with the system. You start off with the bedrock of it, the presumption of innocence. So we must prove our case so that they're sure of the guilt or they don't have a reasonable doubt or whichever way that's being put together these days as a direction. But there's always going to be that because you're dealing with a cross-section of humanity, many of whom it'll be an inconvenience in their life to be dragged away for a couple of 3 weeks of jury service. But they're human beings and they want to hear a story, I think. That some will want to assess the evidence, but some will be asking the what-if questions and trying to fill in the blank spaces that the evidence perhaps hasn't provided for them.
You're right, and it's the human factor, isn't it? And the human factor brings in all the biases and prejudices and different routes that they want to go down, whether they like the defendant, whether they don't. Oh, I don't like someone with tattoos, so therefore they're guilty. You'll get all that, won't you? And that's why you have 12 of them, because you try and have a cross-section of society that could possibly give you, at very least, a 10-2 verdict.
Mm. There was a 2010 report by the Ministry of Justice that revealed that 2/3 of jurors don't fully comprehend the judge's legal directions when they retire to consider their verdicts. Two-thirds, that's just quite frightening. I mean, I don't know what the figure is now, but yeah, that's. If I was on trial, I'd find that a bit worrying.
And yet, with some exceptions, it continues, I think, as a system to turn out tolerably reasonable justice. I've had cases where juries have decided, I think, where they haven't liked the victim. And the victim's come across poorly to them, and that hasn't helped their deliberations. And people who I from my admittedly biased view, were pretty sure were guilty of the offences. Well, I was sure beyond reasonable doubt of that they committed the offences, were found not guilty by a jury. But all that means is the evidence, including how the victim puts themselves across, how the defendant puts themselves across, how they're represented, went into that jury room and they came out with a verdict. They couldn't be reasonably sure. I'm okay with that. And I think in both cases, the victims were okay with that. They'd had a day in court, they'd seen the evidence put before a jury and a not guilty verdict, but at least they'd had the day in court.
You're asking a race of people, you're asking human beings who are hardwired to be subjective and judgmental in many ways, to be objective for a short time. Leave all that at the door and base something just on the facts, and it's just not going to happen. But it's the best you've got. And if you're going to have those 12 peers to judge somebody and find guilt or not, they're going to bring all that with them.
I guess you've had a lifetime of legal training and you've been in the courts and you sat in the judge's seat. Yeah, you can probably be objective and you can give your direction and you can make notes as to what are the facts in the case and what's been put forward. You can't demand the same off 12 people you brought in off the street.
Well, that's a really interesting point you raise, because, again, from the article in 2013, the writer Peter Moffat, who spent 9 years as a criminal defence barrister, says that as lawyers, you would always understand the concept of categorising stuff, of keeping the case separate from the outside world. It's very difficult as a member of the public to close down parts of your brain. Inevitably, you bring in outside influences, which is basically exactly what you've just said, isn't it?
It stands to reason. It couldn't be other.
I do think, though, that there has been more and more armchair experts, whether that be the armchair experts on Twitter or the fact that they've watched 4 box sets of Murder, She Wrote, that they're experts on how the police should have got about things.
If you want an interesting comparison, and sitting at your local magistrate's court where the conviction rates are higher, where the cases don't take as long and you rarely see a barrister, those are interesting cases to look at, because the judgments at magistrate's court are, in my experience, come to more rapidly, perhaps sometimes more lenient, but in terms of having to prove your case to a certainty, that may not be happening all the time at magistrate's court. It may be enough to hear the police say their thing, give their evidence, and that's the minds made up. That's that sort of summary, swift justice. The majority of what we do doesn't end up at Crown Court, doesn't end up in front of a jury, ends up at the magistrate's court in front of lay magistrates, or perhaps a stipendiary magistrate, a professional magistrate, legally advised by a court clerk, and it's a whole different process.
Do we think age is a factor in jury trials? Obviously, as the years go on and new generations come through, we talked about this gap between current and previous generations. Again, I'm just wondering whether a younger jury member would...
You need to have that cross-section of the community, from race, colour, age, sex. So... Yeah, if there's a trial and it's a complex online fraud, for example, would you want a 70-year-old to be judging it? Well, yes, because that's the cross-section of the community. But what I'm saying is you've got to have a 25-year-old in there. You've got to have a 35, 45-year-old in there, because it's the balance of it all. And the fact, you know, there's age prejudice as well. And you can't just say, oh, well, for the most complex and... you know, crimes, we need people to be younger, because there's age prejudice in society, which people will subjectively project onto a defendant if they're a member of a jury.
First, get yourself a good leading barrister. I've taken complex international frauds to Crown Court before, and if you've got the right barrister, it's like a magic carpet ride, because they absorb the case. If they've got experience in the area, they know how to present that to a jury. They know how to get it across that cross-section of people that are sat there in the jury box. So it's worth spending the money on a complex fraud to get a barrister who's good at them. Same for the defence, I guess, but who can break down the issues so that the jury can understand what it is. Just take the time, set out the case, set out the facts, adduce the evidence. It's really important, and it gets me back to there's reasons why some barristers are paid more than others.
It's all well and good having the 12 good men and women. Make them good men and women to receive the instruction and receive the evidence. I don't think we serve anybody by having really complex cases by people who don't understand the subject matter.
And I would say it's the skill of a really good barrister who's experienced in that area, QC, which to lead the jury through that so that they can be sure of the guilt.
Well, certainly the one piece of kit that seems to feature in every single case these days is a mobile phone, doesn't it? And mobile phone records, text messages and all the rest of it. And certainly I've been in cases which have been dependent, partly at least, on that sort of evidence. And it's a very, very thin line that the prosecution tread between giving enough information and then giving too much and the jury switch off, because it's a lot to take in. And once you've lost them, you've lost them.
You'd never want to get to that my eyes glazed over moment with the jury. So the knack of it, I think, is to be technically correct, but use reasonably simple language to get your technical point across.
Yeah, the problem with using simple language sometimes in technical cases, it's not technical enough to prove the point. You need the full weight of that evidence to land. And if you start watering it down a little bit because of the use of softer language, I actually don't think you're presenting the case properly.
I don't agree. And part of the expert system is that if the defence have got an expert as well.
Well, I'm going to say, God forbid that happens, and then yes. the jury's head will be spinning.
What you're meant to do is to actually talk and see if you can come to common ground on what the evidence
on
is.
On the points you do agree, yes. And discuss the ones you don't.
Exactly, yes. That, yes.
Well, that brings us on to another interesting point, doesn't it? Because those of us have been in court and the summing up speeches are done, after all the evidence is heard, the defence will normally finish their speech with to the jury that you must be sure, and they will really hammer it down. You must be sure. It's not so much the evidence in the case, but it's undermining it or attack its credibility. It's the old saying, isn't it? Courage of your convictions. I honestly think some people don't understand the reasonable doubt, which comes back to not following the judge's directions. And I think people are scared to send people to prison.
I think we're more of a risk-averse society. I don't think people are more inclined to say, yeah, I'm 100% sure on this. Because that's what we're saying for beyond all reasonable doubt, aren't we?
Well, are we though? That's the point. Are we saying beyond reasonable doubt is 100% sure? It's not the same thing, I don't think.
No, I think we need to be up there, don't we? We need to, beyond all reasonable doubt, as in, well, an alien didn't come and land a saucer and take someone away. Reasonable doubt.
Well, I suppose a good analogy is the fingerprint, isn't it? The fingerprint, there is nobody else in the world that has a fingerprint, but a DNA hit, even if it's a 1 to 1 billion chance hit, is still not 100% accurate, whereas a fingerprint is. Now, somebody's mentioned a bit of a halfway house, perhaps, from what we're discussing, is maybe make the judge party to the jury's deliberations. For anybody that hasn't been to court, may surprise you to know that the only people that know what goes on in the jury room are the jury. Nobody else knows and nobody will ever know.
I think that's an idea right up there with allowing investigating officers to be present at private consultations. It's just not a good idea. If the jury want to know something, they can send out a note and ask the judge. And, you know, I think in the Vicky Price case, there was, what, 10 or a dozen different notes came out from the jury asking for clarification and explanation from the learned judge. And then what does the judge do? You know, if they're listening and things are, you know, a decision on guilty has been made and the judge isn't sure about it, or a not guilty has been made and the judge isn't sure about it because they've listened, there must be some certainty and finality in appearing before a court. You've got the presumption of innocence. The whole idea of a trial is if you're found not guilty, that's it. Unless some staggering new evidence comes in, that's it. You're over and done.
You can't have 12 people being led by a judge in the room, because straight away, those 12 people are just going to look at the judge and go, well, what do you think? What is guilty the right answer? Not guilty. He or she will just lead the jury. That jury room needs to be just them.
I wasn't suggesting that they were actually physically in the room, but maybe party to the reasonings behind some of the questions that they asked. But, well, there's that old saying, isn't there? It's better that a guilty man walks free than an innocent man goes to jail. It's a topic that has exercised legal brains for years now, and I'm sure will continue to do so. But I think, I mean, I've been playing devil's advocate today, to be honest with you. I'm pretty much like Steve and Richard, only because they're looking at me really sternly and I'm frightened. Yeah, it's got to be a jury, hasn't it? And I think the majority of judges and barristers and the British population still share that view.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
This is Radio Nightjack and the Thin Blue Mind podcast.
This is Radio Nightjack, broadcasting from a comfortable location in rural East Lancashire. I was sat in the bakery this morning, and my thoughts ran to the piece of police reform that I detest most of everything that's been done to policing over the last decade or so. I'm talking, of course, about police and crime commissioners. Now, there's no argument. It was a Conservative Lib Dem manifesto pledge in 2010 to make the police more accountable through a different sort of oversight, replacing police authorities, which would change according to the makeup of the local council politically, and which were pretty explicitly political bodies. And the idea was to provide a directly elected individual subject to some strictish checks and balances. And those checks and balances were to be by an oversight committee of locally elected representatives. There's been a slide in policing, and I think in our political ways generally, towards the American way of doing things. We have this idea that the Prime Minister is no longer the primus inter pares, the first amongst equal. No, they're a presidential figurehead. And when we're voting nationally, we're increasingly encouraged not to vote for particularly the local candidates, but for the colour of the rosette that they are wearing and the political party that rosette represents. That's sad. It's a diminishment of our democracy, I think. And part of entrenching this idea into our body politic, I think, has been the Police and Crime Commissioner, a locally elected representative who will have a large amount of power over the financing and the direction of policing within the constabulary that they cover. It was explicitly said at the time that it would allow the Home Office to withdraw from day-to-day policing matters. Well, we've seen how that's worked out recently with the Met. We've ended up with such a big policing body, such a big organisation, under the purview of the Mayor of London, because, of course, they decided to go further down the American way of doing things and have locally elected mayors with actual strong political power within their area, just like America. And that mayor would also be effectively responsible for the police and crime commissioner duties in their area if they wanted to take those on. So we've ended up with police and crime commissioners. We've ended up with a very, very strong person in policing in the local landscape. There are fewer and fewer of them that are independent as the years go by. There are fewer and fewer of them that actually enjoy a strong mandate. Turnout for police and crime commissioner elections, despite efforts to make it more popular, to get more voters to vote for it, are low. Really, really low. So you have somebody with a lot of power and not a lot of mandate from the public. So what do they get to do, these American-style police commissioners? You know, I'm thinking, you know, you've got the police, you've got Commissioner Gordon, you're just probably short of Batman. Anyway, they make an annual report on their progress. They're meant to hold chief constables to account for delivery of a policing plan, which has to be drawn up by the police and police and crime commissioner. So they've got to produce a police and crime plan every year. They hold the police fund. They have the power to appoint, suspend or dismiss chief constables. On the other hand, they're not meant to fetter the operational independence of police constables, but the police chief constable is meant to be dealing with somebody who can appoint, suspend or dismiss them. That's a pretty big stick to have in your hand. They're meant to secure and maintain efficient and effective police forces in their areas. Well, when we look at what's been happening with the number of forces going into special measures, the number of forces that have recently been shown as being inadequate in various areas by inspection, you could make a strong argument that in quite a lot of areas, they have not secured or maintained efficient or effective police forces. They also do a thing called setting the local precept. The local precept is part of the council tax that goes to pay for council services. It's that part of it which goes towards policing. And there's an amount that they can apply to have the precept raised by. And in times of austerity, some have gone to raise the local precept and try to keep policing afloat by increasing the council tax, and some have not. Because it puts the responsibility for funding, which has largely been central in our system, funding of policing has largely been central in our system. And if there's a lack of funding, it can be pointed, well, that's a local issue. That's an issue for the Police and Crime Commissioner. They hold the police fund. They set the local precept. Nothing to do with central government gov. It's a local problem. But again, we know after 10 years of austerity, that's not really how it works. So much of that funding comes centrally. The funding formula is massively tricky and complex. It's meant to be being redrawn and resorted, but that's no sign of that happening anytime soon. So they start off with an uneven playing field. Some have got a very good funding settlement, some not so good. That's now their responsibility, nothing to do with the Home Office. So they have this weak mandate. They don't do very popularly in the elections. It got to the point where in 2014, the Lib Dems said that they would probably scrap the system if they had their time over again. And like I say, again, they've been replaced in some places by the elected mayor, Greater Manchester, the Met, West Yorkshire. They all have a mayor who acts as the police and crime commissioner. If you want to give yourself a treat, see if you can track down a Channel 4 programme which followed one of the first PCCs, Anne Barnes, in 2014, as she took over in Kent. Just to show what can happen with the police and crime commissioner, she took over direct control of the local police comms. She had a policing model, which she described as the policing onion, which she wanted Kent to work to. The Fly on the Wall documentary made it clear she didn't really properly understand the policing onion, which was a shame. She ended up apologising for how she appeared on this Fly on the Wall documentary. But I think the killer was before the election. She called police and crime commissioners a willful waste of money that will inevitably lead to confrontational governments. And in that, I think she was right. And it's a shame. It's a shame the way that's worked out, I think. I don't think it's improved policing. I don't think it's protected policing or policing funding. I don't think it's been better in terms of value for money than the police authority used to be. It's a shame. So, American tune. Still, when I think of the road we're travelling on, I wonder what went wrong. I can't help it. I wonder what went wrong. And that's the road we're travelling on. Anyway, this is Radio Nightjack saying thank you and goodbye. See you soon. Take care.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time, on the next podcast, take care.